Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, celebrating the Aliento Tequila photo exhibit with a tequila tasting and other entertainment, November 8th, 6 to 9 p.m. Ticket info and more at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Meat has long been ingrained in the American identity as a meal staple, but there are growing health and environmental concerns related to its consumption and production. But meat, especially beef, it dominates our menus. Here's how actor Sam Elliott puts it.
Beef stroganoff, beef bourguignon, Irish beef stew, beef brisket, Chateaubriand, sauerbraten, roast beef, Catalonian beef ragu, Mongolian beef, chicken fried steak, steak Diane, grilled steaks balsamico, hamburgers, sizzling beef, spicy braised beef, barbecued beef ribs, beef Wellington, pepper beef, beef jerky, beef with broccoli, beef burritos, beef fajitas, beef tacos. Do you see where I'm going with this? Beef. It's what's for dinner.
How do meat and meat-like products, how are they going to find their way into that list read off by Sam Elliott and into a sustainable food future? Have you tried the meat alternatives that are now on the market, the plant-based meat burgers and tacos, and what did you think? Are you willing to make these non-meat meats a regular part of your eating habits? Why or why not? And what do you think the future of meat is in America and across the planet? Call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @tprsource. If you work in a restaurant that serves these products, at a fast food restaurant or a high-end restaurant, you know, tell us what kind of market are you seeing? Are consumers calling for these products as well? So our guest this afternoon, we're joined by Richard Waite. He's associate in the food program at the World Resource Institute, author of the World Resources Report, Creating a Sustainable Food Future. Richard, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much.
Laura Riley's here, reporter covering the business of food for The Washington Post. Laura, hi. And Jillian Mock joins us, freelance science journalist covering the environment and climate change for the New York Times and Popular Science and Texas Climate News Magazine. Jillian Mock, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, let's go to Richard Waite over at the Food Resource Institute. So as we have this conversation about meat alternatives, what are you thinking about? What's on your menu as you look at this situation?
Well, we start by looking at the big picture, look out to the year 2050, where the world is probably going to have to feed about 10 billion people. And at the same time, we're also going to have to deal with climate change and limit that as much as possible. So the challenge is trying to figure out how to feed more people while at the same time halting deforestation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and so improving agriculture as a part of that, reducing food waste as a part of that. But in areas where we consume a lot of meat, shifting to a diet that's higher in plants is also a part of the puzzle.
But people, we say when you start messing with my hamburger, this no longer becomes an academic exercise. This gets really real for people. Jillian Mock, as you cover the environmental and climate change for the New York Times, I'm sure you've also talked to people who have tried these products and they don't know what to make of it.
Tried the plant-based products?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a decent amount of excitement and also skepticism. It seems like sort of a mixed bag. I'm from Texas originally, and so whenever I go home, I know that my family at least is a little bit skeptical of anything that's not like the real thing, which I'm sure is something that many other Texans realize. I don't think people like you telling them what to eat, but as Richard said, I mean, it's a huge problem. And one of the interesting things about our diet is it's something that, you know, an individual can actually have a fairly big impact on something that's structural, which is kind of the whole issue with climate change in general. But it's certainly something that makes a lot of people uncomfortable too.
Laura Riley with the Washington Post. So you're with us now, right?
I sure am.
Great. So tell me about how this happened, how suddenly it seemed like, you know, we turned around and Impossible Burgers were showing up on fast food menus, and what drove that?
Well, it's interesting. So I got a report today from the MPD group, which is usually very conservative, and they have been for years saying, you know, the beef burger is king. There's no moving the needle on that, and all of a sudden they are seeing the needle moved. It's interesting that this past year, in you know, since April, one of the most ordered late night things on Uber Eats is the Impossible Burger. You know, so that's us. Who's eating stuff late at night? You know, it's the kind of post-drinking, you know, stoner crowds.
The munchie guy.
The munchie, you know, if that's the craveable food right now, that says something about culture and about the zeitgeist shifting. I think that what we're seeing is that millennials and Gen Z grew up in the era of climate change. You know, my generation, it was like Jaws, Killer Bees, and the Soviet Union, you know. And for the youngins, they have lived with the specter of climate change since their earliest memories. And I think that if there is something discernible that they can do behaviorally that changes things swiftly, they're inclined and willing to do so. And, you know, by most people's metrics, the plant-based meats will, it's like 90% less greenhouse gas emissions, 45% less energy usage, 99% less water. And I think people are hearing those stats and listening to all of the accumulated data right now, the Eat Lancet report or the UN climate change report, that say we have got to pivot away from red meat and towards either a plant-based or even just, you know, poultry or other things that are a little bit climate friendlier.
Right. So we use terms now like meat, and there are some questions about whether or not we could actually call this meat or alternative meat. We call it plant-based meat. That's like jumbo shrimp, sort of a contradiction in terms. Richard Waite, what do you call these things?
I mean, I've heard them called different things. I generally call them plant-based meats. I think that's what the makers of these products tend to call themselves, because I think what's different about these products versus sort of the veggie burgers of yore is that they are really trying to replicate that meat eating experience, and it's not, these are products that are not only intended for vegans and vegetarians, but also, you know, your mainstream meat eater, carnivore. And I think these companies are also reporting that the majority of the customers that are eating their products also do eat meat.
You know, I think, I don't know if this is a good comparison or not, and any of you guys jump in and tell me if you think I'm just thinking about it in this way. As we know, we used to only have natural fibers around using in our clothing and stuff, but then with the discovery of things like nylon and rayon and all these other different synthetic fibers, that became a huge game changer in textiles and what we wear and the type of fashion choices that we can make. Is this going to be kind of along those lines? Maybe, you know, we're just, it's going to be sort of a synthetic meat, and that could change to, you know, and people will adopt it after they get used to it. And so go ahead.
I think that's a fascinating comparison. I mean, obviously with plastics, we're talking about massive unintended and negative consequences in terms of plastic particles and, you know, everything we eat basically in the oceans. But I think in terms of plant-based, we're not talking about synthetic. I mean, I just did a breakdown of Impossible Burger for the paper, and it's mostly food. You know, it's not, the lion's share
sure.
of these products.
It's but it's not meat. It didn't come from a cow. So that's the thing that people are curious about. So when we come back from the break, we will take a deeper dive into what exactly is in these Impossible or these other plant-based burgers. What makes it a burger? What makes it taste so good? The number is 210-614-8980. The source continues after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the future of meat and if there is an appetite with the American consumer for these alternative meat-like products. The number to call in, tell us what you think. Have you tried them? Were you surprised? And will you do it again? Or was it lesson learned for you? The number is 210-614-8980. Let's go to Serena on the phones. And Serena, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you. My concern with you know, Impossible Burger or any of the other brands is that it's lab grown, and that it may not be any more nutritional for us than eating just the actual plants. I'm worried that they consist of chemicals and oils and things that really just aren't going to be any more nutritious or beneficial for our bodies than meat is.
All right. Serena, thank you for that question. Let me go to Richard Waite first on that with the World Resources Institute. What do we know about how these meat, these plant-based patties are created?
Sure. So I think my understanding of on from a nutrition perspective, if you look for at the Impossible Burger, for example, so if you look at nutrition facts side by side of what's in beef and what's in an Impossible Burger, side by side nutritionally, they're pretty comparable. So if you're it's not terribly better for you or worse for you. It's sort of like a lateral move. I think to your question, I mean, if folks are switching from eating salads and eating rice and beans to eating Impossible Burgers all the time, that would probably be, a step backwards both for health and for the environment. But I think if they're swapping out beef sometimes for Impossible Burgers, it's kind of a lateral step in terms of nutrition. And then, as Laura mentioned, you do get it is better for the environment because it uses less resources.
And Jillian Mock with the New York Times freelancer with the environment and climate change that you're writing for, I see 22 grams of fat in both of these patties. So, but it's a different kind of fat, right?
It's obviously not beef fat that's in your Impossible Burger, but I also, the goal I don't think is to be healthier than a burger. It's to, provide you with the same amount of protein as a burger and kind of pack a similar nutrition punch so that, it's not this health food, but it is kind of a one-to-one replacement at that level. And then it's better because it has such a significantly smaller footprint on the environment. So certainly it's, from my understanding, it's not better for you than a salad. But it's also not supposed to be, if that makes sense.
Right. So it's not being promoted as health food. But it is. How is it being promoted? What is the angle, Laura Riley?
Well, 89% of the people eating these things don't identify as vegetarians. So these are products that are, for right now, whether you're talking about Impossible or Beyond or any of the ones that are coming out from Smithfield and Purdue and Cargill, and every company's coming out with one. Their goal is verisimilitude right now. It's to be as closely, akin to meat, to be undetectably not meat. And so you're achieving that with fats like coconut oil, sunflower oil, things that are saturated that are not necessarily better for you than the saturated fat in meat. But I think that moving forward, once this category has matured a little bit, we're really in its infancy right now, those products will move healthier and healthier because I think that that's what the dining public is grasping for or wishing for. But for right now, just to move that needle and to get us to accommodate this, we want it to be as akin to meat as it can be.
All right, let's go to Sylvia on the phones. Number is 210-614-8980. Sylvia, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad you're having this discussion. I haven't eaten meat since 71 when I read Diet for a Small Planet that I'd like to plug. It's still readable, except that meat's even worse for the environment. Now, my question, isn't it, in terms of trying to save this small plant, isn't it to do what she did, the author, to say, just eat less, right? Nobody's asking you to have a perpetual Lent. Just eat less meat, right?
Right. Sylvia, thank you for that. And Jillian Mock with the New York Times, and we talk about environment and climate change, but we're also talking about how we can change the habits of consumers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of the whole purpose of the One Thing We Can Do column over in the Times newsletter that I write for. And it is this idea that, and Richard also has some great numbers on this, that if you eat less and kind of make meat this thing that's precious and this thing that is special instead of something that you eat at every single meal, you maybe don't have to cut it out entirely, but you will have this great impact on the environment. I think when it comes to our diet, there's a lot of things that we think that we can do. But really the single most impactful thing you can do if you are eating a lot of meat is to eat less, because it just has this pretty big footprint. I mean, I think they say it's responsible for like 14% meat and dairy, like 14% of the world's greenhouse gases. So it's something that consumers can do that's actionable. So I think that's exactly right.
And Richard, wait, so what are the numbers, what do they look like for creating a sustainable food future? I mean, as you said, in the next 30 years, the global appetite for beef is expected to double, particularly coming from China and India, other countries that are now prospering. So actually the future for meat means is that there's going to be more demand for it. How does this factor into that?
Yeah, sure. So that's exactly the challenge. So we used some numbers from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, looking at to the year 2050, and projected that global beef demand is on a course to grow about 80% between 2010 and 2050, along with other foods. And the thing that we looked at too is as the population grows towards 10 billion people. So what are the land use requirements? And we modeled that out, and we, even assuming continued improvements in agriculture, because there's been vast improvements in farming and ranching over the past few decades, even if you project those out into the future, to meet that projected future demand, we estimated that the world is likely to clear another 600 million hectares of forest and bring that into agriculture. And to give you a sense of the scale of that, that's almost twice the size of India. And so if we do that, It basically makes it impossible to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. And so the thing that shifting to a diet that's lower in meat and higher in plants does is it means your individual diet takes up less space, and it also means then that as you add more people to the planet, you make it easier to feed everybody without knocking down more forests.
Laura Riley, as this business gets bigger, scales up, becomes a global supply chain, are we going to see prices decrease? Because right now it's kind of like the same price for an Impossible Burger for a regular burger.
Undoubtedly, economies of scale. As soon as these companies scale up, everything will get cheaper. And one thing we haven't really brought into this conversation yet is the lab grown meat that is right around the corner. So this is meat that is grown in a medium from a punch biopsy the size of a sesame seed from an actual animal. No animal has to die in the making of this meat. And whether the public will embrace this kind of meat is yet to be seen. But plant-based to me seems a little bit like the warning shot, this kind of beginning of this new era of how we eat and what we eat. And the lab-grown, I think that there are some lab-grown products, meat products that will come to the market in 2020.
Let's go to Andres on the air. Andres, welcome to The Source. You're on the air, and you have a question along those lines.
Hello. Yeah. My question is more about lab-grown meat. You just started talking about that. And I wanted to know whether or not, I guess it's sort of a maybe philosophical question or ethical question. Is lab-grown meat considered real meat or real meat from the scientific community?
All right, Andreas, thank you for that call. So some people call it clean meat. Some people have called that cruelty-free meat. But is this red meat? And let me go first to Richard White to get your reaction.
Yeah, so our research actually has looked more at plant-based meat than lab-grown meat, just because that's what's available on the market today, and we're interested in sort of the shifts that consumers or food providers could make, starting tomorrow if they wanted to. So I actually haven't looked as close into that question, so maybe others.
Yeah, Laura Riley, can you talk about that? Is this going to be considered red meat, and what is the profit potential for this industry?
So it is bioidentical. that once it's grown, you know, the stuff that will come to market first is unstructured because it's easier to make. It's very, very technically difficult to make a ribeye steak, say, you know. But so we will see what amounts to a ground product, whether that's a pork or a beef or a chicken, come on the market next year. It will be really expensive to begin with because they have to amortize the cost of that, all of that R&D. I mean, it's been enormously expensive already to get close to this. But the companies that are launching have their eye on the long term and know that if these products are embraced and they scale up, the price will come down. And I think that they anticipate, and plant-based people too, that those prices will undercut traditional, you know, animal agriculture.
And we're talking like a multi-billion-dollar industry. The companies that are able to produce this at scale and satisfy consumer demand, Laura?
Barclays is saying they're estimating that by 2030, plant-based meat will be a $140 billion market. So they're anticipating this is huge. And there are segments. I mean, China has an enormously growing middle class. And what happens when you have an emerging middle class? They eat more animal protein. And just this past year, the Chinese swine herd has been decimated by African swine fever. So there's a huge need for pork right now in China. If lab-grown or plant-based pork can kind of, in a regulatory way, get there, that's a really untapped market.
And Jillian Mock, as this develops, will this take pressure off of the climate change forces, or will this just help maintain market demand?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, I am not entirely sure. I would imagine that it will be beneficial in terms of greenhouse gas reduction if you have, you know, this industry reaching a point where it is actually replacing actual burgers and meat meals at some kind of significant scale. Right now, it's so small that it, you know, really can't do that. So if it does scale up to that degree, like, yes, of course, you're going to have, I think you're going to see a greenhouse gas benefit. So it just depends on what kind of impact that has, I think, depends on how quickly it happens.
Yes, I wonder, though, if as climate change becomes more apparent and the catastrophe becomes unavoidable and the government is forced to actually take action and impose carbon taxes on industries, and whether or not that industry will include beef production. And so that would add to the cost of real actual beef and make artificial meat, plant-based meat or lab-grown meat more attractive to consumers and provide the offset to climate change. Jillian, is that a workable, you know, scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that is plausible if those things happen, that it could have that kind of market competitiveness. If you're talking about a scenario where we're actually really trying to go after climate change and tax carbon and, you know, take these steps that a lot of people argue we need to take.
And Richard, is that what you see too?
Yeah, I mean, that's when people look at, you know, the types of policies that might encourage this shift a little bit more. Some, you know, people do talk about meat taxes. I mean, I think in some European governments, there's been some discussion lately about what that might look like. Denmark, I think, had a tax on saturated fat for a year that ended up, they actually took it away because people would just go over the border to Germany to buy meat and come back. And so it wasn't having the intended effect. So, I mean, that's one thing that could change, that can, you know, change consumption patterns. But I mean, it's interesting that even the private sector today is looking at, you know, there's different, potential ways to market these plant-based, meats or even plant-based dishes more broadly that aren't just the that aren't just the sort of the high-tech meat replacements.
Yeah,
and we found an. Oh yeah, go ahead.
No, I got to wrap this up. We got to go to another break. But our phone lines are open. We're talking about the future of meat. If you have tried these impossible or beyond meat products, what do you think? Is this something that you would be able to add to you and your family's diet menu more often? Are you also thinking about the ethical parts of this? Because now you don't have to kill a cow or whatever in order to have good meat. So call in. The number is 210-614-8980. The source continues.
Cultural heritage is constantly at risk by population growth, natural disasters, and climate change. When do you know when heritage is worth saving?
What is the contemporary value of the heritage now? And then we're going to make choices about how we're going to respect it and care for it into the future.
Cultural heritage next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the future of meat. If you've gone through a fast food window recently, you may have noticed some products called Impossible Burgers or Beyond Burgers. Other places are selling this meat that is not really meat. It's a plant-based meat. And the predictions are that there's a market for this. And if you've tried it, tell us what you like about it. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. Cindy has called in. Cindy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My comment or question is, I know that the Impossible Burger and the lab-grown meat is better for the environment than conventionally raised beef, but how does it compare to sustainably grown, grass-fed beef raised on a regenerative agricultural farm that's actually adding nutrients back into the soil? How does that compare?
Cindy, thank you for the call. Richard Waite, can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So that's a really good question. It's one that we get a lot. So one thing that's kind of interesting when comparing grass-fed to or I should say grass-finished to grain-finished beef is that so grain-finished beef, it actually takes the cows a little bit longer to reach slaughter weight, and they're slaughtered at a lower weight. So the emissions per pound of meat from grass-finished beef actually tend to be a bit higher than they are for sort of the conventional grain-finished beef that makes up like 95% of the beef that we consume in the U.S. There is quite a bit of interest around regenerative agriculture, capturing more carbon in soils, and there's some interesting examples in a couple places in the U.S. where there's actual data behind that. I think there's a lot of hope that it will be possible to sequester more carbon in grazing soils. I think we're in early stages of actually having data to prove that. And I guess the one other thing that I would say is that even in a more regenerative system that does sequester more carbon, you're still talking about a relatively small amount of food produced over a large amount of land. So thinking forward to, you know, adding another 2 billion people to the planet, if people want to eat beef and people want to eat beef that's raised like that, then that's still going to require a lot of land, and we're still going to have pressure on forests. So even if there is, you know, a shift towards more grass-finished, more regenerative beef, there's still kind of finite room on the planet.
And let's go to Miles. Miles, thanks for calling into The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. Long-time listener, first-time caller. My main concern and question sort of revolve around diversity in the, like, where you buy meat, H-E-B, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods. And I want to ask, like, how do we as a community, or maybe there's other examples around the country, how do we convince these sellers to diversify their meat sections? There's certain H-E-Bs that you go to where the meat sections are 3 to 4 times larger than the produce sections, and it just doesn't seem right. It's like, why does there need to be that much product out there? If you have any thoughts on that or what we could do, I'd love to hear it.
All right, Miles. How are grocery chains responding to this alternative meat situation? Laura Riley, that's where people, you know, make their eating decisions, right?
Sure. Well, it's supply and demand. But I think one thing that's interesting to me is where these Beyond or Impossible meats are in the grocery store. They're not in the produce aisle. They're right next to traditional, you know, animal ag beef. So they're really gunning for that space. And I think that we'll see more and more. I mean, there's already, I think, a couple hundred SKU numbers that are for plant-based meats and plant-based meat products and blended products. I mean, that's another huge growth area that we'll see products that are half chicken, half, you know, pea protein or those kinds of things. And I think for a lot of moms trying to feed their, you know, young kids with chicken nugget kind of things, I think it is a little bit of a pivot mentally, you know, okay, maybe if I can introduce a little bit more vegetable matter into their diet without changing the basic building blocks of what they eat, I can feel better about it. So I think that we will see a lot more of those. As per produce, the unfortunate truth about the American diet is that we eat a lot of prepared food. The argument is like, oh, we should all be eating a whole food diet. We should all be preparing food at home. And we do that less and less and less. That most of us, there was a new study from, gosh, I can't remember who came out with it yesterday, about the amount of prepared food we're buying in the grocery store or having delivered. And it's just gone up year over year. So I don't see that trend changing.
But do you see this Impossible Beyond Meat turning up in things like the frozen food aisle, like in my packet of Lean Cuisine, or in the chicken McNuggets that you pull out of the freezer section is going to be the Impossible chicken stuff. So it's going to be all over the store. It's going to be in the SpaghettiOs and everything else, right?
I think it'll be in food service in elementary schools, at hospitals, at, you know, preschool, all the kinds of, you know, the ballparks. I think that we're going to see that more and more. And I think for restaurants in particular, it's a way of removing veto power. So, you know, if you have a barbecue restaurant, say, and one person in your party is a vegetarian or vegan or doesn't want to eat that kind of stuff for whatever reason, offering a plant-based alternative removes that veto power. So it's just an extra tool in people's arsenals.
Right, but it's going to be everywhere, and it's going to be very, if you don't want to eat this type of meat stuff, it's going to be very difficult to avoid it in the future. Laura, you think?
I don't think so, because I think that labeling will be very transparent. You know,
right.
I think that you're seeing a whole bunch of states, especially, you know, cattle ranching states, push back in terms of nomenclature, what can be on a label. And I think those battles are yet to be really waged entirely. We're still kind of standing by to wait to see what words are going to be allowed on labels. But I think no matter what, transparency will be key, because there are always going to be people who say, I don't really want to eat a highly processed pea protein fake meat. You know, I'd rather eat the real thing or eat, you know, a plant. So I think that there will be better, there'll be effective labeling for all this stuff.
All right. Jillian Mock, science journalist. There's a lot of debate. I see numbers all over the place about how destructive a meat production actually is for the environment. The EPA has one number, but scientists, they come up with a different one. So what are you looking at?
In terms of the numbers I use?
Or what should we think? How is it? Is the meat production one of the leading causes of climate change?
Meat production is definitely a major factor in climate change, partially because of the land use that is involved in it. I mean, that's something the World Resources Institute talks about a lot, is that, I mean, it takes so much more land to produce calorie or, you know, gram of protein of meat than it does for the same amount of calories or proteins in plants. And land use, I think, is something that we don't necessarily talk about as much, but I mean, agriculture dominates the face of this planet at this point and is going to continue to do so as the population continues to grow. And so when you're talking about, especially in places like Brazil, you're clearing forests to graze cattle, I mean, not only do you have to have a certain amount of land to graze those cattle, but all those forests that you burn down are just a huge carbon emission. And at the same time, you're eliminating a carbon sink. So it's a major factor. I mean, I think it's uncomfortable for some people to think about, but it's the reason that people are so interested in these plant-based products, is that this is something that is a significant contributor that you actually have control over. I mean, so is the electricity grid, for example, particularly in the United States. We don't have a particularly clean grid, but beyond, you know, trying to support providers that have some kind of, renewable energy buy-in, you don't really have control over where the electricity is coming from when you flip a switch, unless maybe you have solar panels on your roof. I live in an apartment, so I have no control like that. Bottom line is, when you look at these numbers, it's really hard to know exactly what is the exact right look at, because every single scientist has their own way of accounting for this, and it varies so much based on the provider. So one person could have a relatively clean operation, and then these other operations that produce meat have just like 10 times the focus or something. So hard numbers, I have found, can be difficult to, you know, really quantify. It depends on which factors are important to you. But the bottom line is that this is a factor that is important, that I think is it's valid and good that we're talking about it.
All right. Another caller, Marianne. Marianne, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes. I know that the trigger or the target of the discussion is the plant-based beef, but I'm wondering if we could be more successful and more effective if we ask the question of how much animal farming, animal agriculture, which would include dairy and eggs, for example, can we really tolerate, as opposed to just talking so much about beef?
Okay. Marianne, thank you for that call. And so looking at all of the animal agriculture that we have, Richard Waite, it's not just meat production, but, you know, we've seen this before. We have, you go now to the dairy aisle and they've got soy milk, other products, you know, almond milk. Things are becoming that are not actual dairy being sold as dairy, and people are buying that. And is that putting some relief on the world resources?
Yeah, thanks. No, and that's a good question. I think the reason why people are talking about beef so much in this plant-based discussion is, if you look across all the different foods that we commonly eat, there's sort of three different categories that you can think of if you want to think about either land use or greenhouse gas emissions per unit of food, so like per gram of protein or per calorie. So on the low end, you have, you know, the plant-based foods. So, you know, your grains and your legumes and your fruits and vegetables. On the higher end, on you have your meats that come from ruminant animals. So that's, you know, predominantly in this country, it's beef and lamb. And to give you a sense of the scale, it takes about 20 times the land and it emits 20 times the greenhouse gases to produce a gram of protein of beef versus a gram of protein of beans. Now, then you have this middle category where you have it's most of the other meats, so the pork and the chicken, and then your dairy, your fish, your eggs, where it's still more resource intensive than the plant-based food. So chicken, for example, takes about three times the land. It's about three times the amount of emissions
right.
of beans. But it's less than beef. And so I think that's why the discussion's been centered more on beef there. But yes, there's a win for the environment from shifting, you know, away from the others too.
Got to take a break. 210-614-8980. How you like those Impossible Burgers? The Source continues after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the future of meat. Our phone lines are open, 210-614-8980. Are you a fan of these new alternative meat products? What is it that attracts you to them, or what repels you from them? Do you think this is just an abomination and that we should no way be consuming this stuff at all? Or do you welcome it because you recognize that there is this incredible strain that creating all of these protein products is putting on the environment and on the planet? 210-614-8980. Sasha is on the line. Sasha, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm calling in just as a 25-year vegan and also a nutritionist and bodybuilder. And one question that comes up a lot of the time for people is, you know, is this healthier? And you hear a lot of people say, oh, but it's processed, whatever. And I have to say, I agree. 10 years ago, it was all whole foods as a vegan. You really didn't have a lot of options and you had to get creative. And so my opinion of the widely used now Impossible and Beyond is that I think it's fantastic for the movement, for the environment, for the planet. I don't think it's fantastic for our bodies to abuse vegan fast food the same way we abuse other fast foods. I think they're great intro products for noobs who really want to get to understand veganism, vegetarianism. It makes it way less hard to understand how to cook without using meat, and I think it's a great transition-type food. I also think that, you know, coconut oil versus animal fat in human blood, there's obvious scientific studies behind how that looks, but I still think that we need to eat more plants. And so while I'm super happy to see more products being widely used, it's just, you know, like some other callers have said, organics are always going to be better. Hormones, food without hormones, you know, are always going to be better. And processed food isn't the answer forever,
right.
But it's a great transition.
Sasha, thank you for calling in with that. Laura Riley, reporter covering business of food at the Washington Post. I'm sure they've done a lot of consumer testing about who are the people who are most likely to buy these items. And who what have they found?
Well, if you talk to someone like Patrick Brown, the CEO of Impossible, his target is not the vegans and vegetarians. His target is omnivores and carnivores. And it's interesting. I mean, they're a lot of these companies are zealots. They want to obviate the need for animal agriculture altogether. You know, they have these targets that to me seem very ambitious, you know, 2050, to get rid of all animal ag in favor of either plant-based or lab-grown.
But they want market forces to drive that transition, right?
Absolutely, yeah, and they think it's essential to save the planet. The previous caller I think is absolutely right, but we're talking about don't let the good be the perfect, the enemy of the perfect. I mean, we as a culture increasingly outsource the production of our food. As of 2017, we spent more dollars in food service than we did at the grocery store. So we are already not cooking our own meals. So the prevalence of processed food or prepared food is likely to continue to rise. So, you can't really do the hand-wringing, we should all just be making all of our, we should be growing and making our own food at all times. And obviously our human health would be better off. The surge in lifestyle-related diseases would probably take a different turn if we all ate that way, but we're not doing it.
Right, but I mean, here you're just a guy. You typically would eat a lot of meat. You know, the average American eats 200 pounds of meat a year. And I drive up in the drive-through window, and I see Impossible Burger on the little panel there, and I say, well, why don't I try that? I know it's not real meat; that it's plant-based, but I'm interested in that. Do we know what's driving that decision making? Is it ethics? Like, I don't want to have to kill a cow today, or I realize I'm making a better choice for the environment, or the novelty, or what is it that really is making people? And according to market, this stuff is selling. What's driving that transition? What is the need? Laura, have they found anything?
For younger people, it is all the environment and animal cruelty. Those are the two main drivers, according to questionnaires. For older people, I think it's a mixed kind of agenda. But I think that we'll continue to see that. And if you really, once you get the cheese on there and the tomatoes and the condiments or whatever, if it's 97% of the way there, in terms of undetectability, I think a lot of people are willing to make that shift. And one thing we also have to bear in mind is that it we're talking really strictly in terms of burgers. Burgers are mostly or largely the stuff that the runoff that of we like steaks, and there are a finite number of steaks on every cow, right? Ground beef tends to be what's left, and it also tends to be what happens to dairy cows at the end of their lives, Holsteins at the end of their lives. So we're not going to save the planet just by eating burgers. We also have to transition from eating those steaks. And so that's the big question of whether we're going to, be willing or able to make that shift.
It's also, tacos and burritos and lasagna and other places where you would put meat. There's a lot more variety to it. Jillian Mock, freelance science writer, how hard was it for these people to come up with that umami sensation, the satisfying taste of these burgers?
That's a good question. I think maybe Laura could speak more to that because I was just looking at one of her articles on this. I think it's a fascinating question. It's really hard to make something taste like something that it's not. Also, it's something that food scientists have been doing for decades.
Yeah, and Richard Waite, as we look for the maintaining the planet and sustainable food future, is this going to be how heavy-handed will governments be in trying to drive this transition?
Well, I mean, I think your crystal ball is as good as mine on that question, especially looking out to the year 2050. I mean, I would say I mean, especially in, you know, in this country, what I think is really interesting is you know, not so much, you know, what governments are doing, but there's a lot of really interesting things happening in the private sector and the food service industry, trying to figure out, well, how are we going to feed, you know, millennials, the workforce of the future, or today, or, you know, Gen Z, the workforce of the future, how are we going to meet these changes in preferences and so on. And so we've got this initiative called the Cool Food Pledge, and there's already 25 companies that have committed to serving delicious food but reducing the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the food they serve by 25% by 2030, and part of that is going to be serving less meat and more plants. And so it's interesting to see businesses really taking the lead on this for now.
Right. So, but Richard, without carbon tax on beef production and these other mechanisms being in put into this, as the demand for meat continues to grow, double in the next 30 years, is the price of real meat going to double in the next 30 years or even higher, go higher? And then this type of product will become half of what you would pay for meat that we have today. So will price be the driver in this transition?
Well, yeah, so that's another interesting question, because I mean, what really drives consumer choices around?
Well, they say it's price and availability. Those are the two things.
Yep. I was going to say taste, price, and convenience. And so, if these products, right, can win or at least be as good on taste, and can win on price, and can be as good on convenience, then I think, you know, the sky's the limit. But it's, you know, again, it's early days, and it's interesting to see. And it's also interesting that, you know, some of these products are being positioned as premium products for now, right? You pay an extra dollar maybe for the impossible version of the burger at the restaurant. But, you know, is that going to be scalable looking at it into the future? So price is going to be a very interesting aspect of this, I think.
And Laura Riley with the Washington Post, we are seeing response by the beef industry. Are they going to become kind of like the, you know, the coal industry or the car industry fighting against electric vehicles? Are they going to be fighting this change?
Absolutely. They're already fighting tooth and nail on this, you know, in terms of they've got, I think, 11 different suits in different states about nomenclature. I think one thing that we need to back up and talk about a teeny bit is this is going to be a really regulatory thorny thing, because right now the USDA oversees meat, poultry, and eggs. FDA oversees dairy, seafood, produce, packaged goods, bottled water, whole eggs. Very different, you know, and their mechanisms for enforcement are really different. So now you introduce plant-based meat, and then you introduce lab-grown meat, or, you know, what's clean, whatever we're going to call it. Who's overseeing what, and what are, is this a self-policing thing? I mean, there are a lot of questions that are yet to be established in terms of how these things are going to be inspected. You know, I think with USDA, you have at a slaughterhouse, you have a USDA inspector standing there, you know, overseeing things. Is that going to be the same thing with lab-grown meat? Will there be inspectors? So those kinds of things in terms of public safety have to get worked out as well.
So is the key word here consumer choice? Is that what needs to be put out there so that you have a decision that you can make on your own, and that and it's going to be satisfying, it's going to be not unhealthy, and it'll keep the family happy? Laura, is that what needs to be generated?
Certainly, but I think that there are other things like farm subsidies that will have to get reexamined. I mean, as it is right now, a lot of our big commodity foods have incredible subsidies. They have the two bailouts that have happened because of trade wars. So some of those kinds of things will have to be readdressed if we reconfigure how much soy and corn we're growing as animal feed, say, or you know, kind of the pork and beef industries as a whole. I think that some of those kinds of things will determine how many farmers are doing or are growing what kinds of crops.
But right now, the future of meat looks like there's going to be more demand. If you're a cattle rancher, you're not going to go out of business because of a plant. It's still, it's still a cow's world. Richard Waite, is that pretty much right? Just give me a yes or no, because we're short on time.
Yes, I think that's right.
All right. So Richard Waite is associate in the food program at the World Resources Institute and author of the World Resource Report, Creating a Sustainable Food Future. Laura Riley, a reporter covering business of food at the Washington Post. Jillian Mock is a freelance science journalist covering environment and climate change for the New York Times, Popular Science, and Texas Climate News Magazine. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Rospiedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.